At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, what do you know? Two more big bank settlements from the financial crisis. Disney goes data mining. And hey, did you happen to catch Downton Abbey last night? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcast.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 7th of January. Good as always to have you with us. And good to be back as well. Took a couple of weeks off for the holidays, thinking that surely by the time I got back, the Congress and the President of the United States would have come to their senses, done the responsible thing, and hammered out a mutually satisfactory agreement about the fiscal you-know-what and all the rest of it. Because honestly, what kind of way is this to run an economy? But the trick's on us, I guess, because here we are again, waiting around for the next crisis that we already know is coming. And while we wait for crises yet to come, we are still trying to get out from under crises past. In separate settlements today, big banks have agreed to part with nearly $19 billion as a way to make amends for the mortgage mess. You know, you add up what banks have paid in financial crisis-related claims, and you've got the equivalent of a small country's gross domestic product, practically. But how much of that money is going to homeowners? Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff gets us going today.
Of today's two settlements, only one helps homeowners directly. The Federal Reserve says 3.8 million people will get some kind of compensation from the 10 banks that signed on to the deal. How much? Anywhere from a few $100 all the way up to $125,000. But for most homeowners who face foreclosure, it won't be much.
$2,000 or $200 does not make a difference in people's lives.
Diane Thompson is with the National Consumer Law Center. She says the headline numbers sound like a lot, but when you spread it out over many banks and many people, it's no longer big money.
Banks have gotten off very lightly, and they have largely been able to structure settlements to their advantage.
For the banks involved, today's $8.5 billion settlement ends a slow and costly review of foreclosure cases. The new deal is designed to give more people more money more quickly. Catherine Porter is a law professor appointed to monitor payments to California homeowners under last year's $25 billion settlement. She says all these deals are a balancing act.
You're trying to deliver relief to a large number of people. You're trying to do it quickly, and you're balancing that against accuracy.
Porter says today's deal could bring some relief to homeowners facing foreclosure who were not covered last year, and some might actually get help from both agreements. Payment to many homeowners from today's settlement is expected to come by the end of March, just in time to pay their taxes. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
All right, so how's this for a fantasy? You take the kids to Disney World, or you go yourself, whatever, and there are no turnstiles to deal with at all. No epic lines at Space Mountain. Magic? Yeah, more like Disney's new magic band. Come springtime, visitors to Disney World will be given wristbands that hold chips, that hold credit card numbers and fast pass codes and other information as well. They may make your life easier, but Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports they may also make the Orlando theme park the happiest data mine on Earth.
What would it mean to your little princess if Mickey Mouse came up to her and knew her name?
Hi, Madison. I like your princess shirt.
It's really Big Brother being brought to the theme park.
That's Dennis Spiegel, president of International Theme Park Services. And he means that in a good way. Spiegel says Disney's new magic bands, which are equipped with radio chips, will let the company do things the industry has only dreamed of doing.
It's enabling Disney to understand, watch, follow, track the guest, and then utilize that information not only during their visit, but for future visits in the years to come.
That's because Disney's Magic Bands double as credit card, room key, and fast pass. They also include your kid's birthday and favorite color if you want. University of Chicago professor Robert Grossman says Disney's using technology that's not terribly different than what's on most smartphones these days. He says he's not concerned Disney's going to abuse this additional data.
The company has a very, very good reputation for handling information safely, for having a very rich consumer experience.
A lot of attention is being paid to the new marketing power these wristbands will give the company. But Len Testa, author of The Unofficial Guide Walt Disney World, says he thinks the company's taking the longer view.
If you go stand in one of the lines in Walt Disney World and you look around, everyone's looking at their cell phone.
Testa says if Disney wants to be relevant in today's digital interactive world, Mickey better know kids' names. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
It's a little creepy, man, I gotta tell you. All right, Wall Street today? Meh. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The thing that makes it possible for you to have a cup of coffee in the morning made from beans that were grown in Costa Rica or Ethiopia, or to wear a shirt made of Egyptian cotton that was manufactured in Indonesia, also brings with it some downsides, like flu pandemics, SARS, the plague, if you go back in history far enough, the kinds of diseases that spread from travel and from the way we do business, from commerce. Mark Harrison tells the story in his new book. It's called Contagion. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You begin this story, or the story, I suppose, begins on the very first page of this book. You quote a historian as saying the two great tyrants of civilization, I suppose, are war and commerce. And then you go on to say that commerce is the worst of them.
Commerce is the greatest tyrant in his sense because over the last 700 years, at least, it's been, I suppose, the most consistent factor in the spread of disease. Wars are obviously very important, but they are more localized and more time-limited, whereas commerce is a consistent factor in spreading human and animal diseases.
Well, in that case, I have to ask you, we've reached you in Seoul, South Korea, and I have to ask you if you washed your hands before you got on the airplane.
Yes, I did, in fact.
Because this is something we all do every day. We exchange these things by virtue of our daily business lives.
We do indeed, yes. But I think commerce is a little bit different because it's not just about the movement of people. It's about the movement of commodities. And I think really from the very first outbreaks of plague along the Mediterranean, there was a close association as far as the locals were concerned with the coming of merchants and the coming of plague.
So they knew, back then they knew what was going on.
Yes, yes, they did really. And I think that's the reason why very, very soon after they began to institute now what we call quarantine. That was an immediate response to a sort of felt need, really, to protect themselves against infection coming from ships.
What do we lose today in terms of global trade because people are worried about the spread of disease? I mean, I can think of SARS in Asia. I can think of mad cow disease, right?
Yeah, it's hard to quantify how much trade is lost. But it's clear that trade is adversely affected by quarantines of all kinds. But I think the most striking examples lately that the general public may have been aware of have been in the trade of animals and meat products, particularly. For instance, in the case of the recent so-called swine flu pandemic.
It occurs to me, actually, that this is fundamentally intractable, right? Because we are only going to be more globalized. There will only be more commerce, both illicit and licit, if you will. And we're going to keep on doing
it. Yeah, in a way, it is intractable. All you can do is reduce the risks.
Yeah.
And I think we can do that in a way which doesn't disrupt the international economy as much as it is at the moment. I mean, instinctively, really, I'm a free trader. I don't want trade to be to be bogged down by quarantines and sanitary embargoes. But at the moment, I think the present regime is not really as good as it should be, either from a public health point of view or from the point of view of, you know, a person who wants to see greater freedom of trade globally.
Right. Mark Harrison is a professor of the history of medicine at Oxford. His book is called Contagion: How Commerce Has Spread Disease. Thanks very much for your time.
Okay, thank you very much.
This is going to sound a little bit counterintuitive, but as useful as smartphones have become for the general public, they have become incredibly powerful tools for the blind. Built-in cameras to help with, say, counting money or reading. GPS and navigation apps to help blind users figure out where they are and what might be around them. So far, it's all been done with standard smartphones and a couple of good apps. But Meg Kramer reports there is a new phone out there now. It's been designed from the ground up for the blind.
I'm Eliza Cooper. I'm a social media consultant, and I happen to be totally blind.
Cooper's packing for a trip from New York to L.A. to visit her family.
I know I need my velvet jacket. That's pretty easy to feel. There's only one of them.
She's picking out her clothes using Color ID, a free app that uses her phone's camera to read colors.
We'll try with this blouse, which I think is yellow-ish, probably.
Color ID, pale blue.
Pale blue.
Light blue.
Cooper's iPhone helps her throughout the day, identifying money, reading printed text, and getting directions. Her phone has replaced most of the devices she used to rely on, and it's cheaper than the standard toolkit that helps blind people get around. A GPS device, screen reading software, a money reader, and more, which can cost over $1,000. So far, Cooper spent about $30 on accessibility apps for her phone.
There is no better tool for blind people than the smartphone.
That's Boaz Zilberman. He's the CEO and founder of Project Ray, an Android phone with an interface designed for blind people. Zilberman says that even though they're powerful tools, smartphones have their limits. For one, you have to be pretty technically agile to use a touchscreen display if you can't see it. That's not a problem for someone like Eliza Cooper, who's been using a screen reader since elementary school. But there's another problem. Some apps on Eliza's phone are only sort of accessible. Screen readers rely on developers to label everything with a descriptive name. And when they don't...
Button. 44
for
button.
There's a button here.
All circles. Button.
Wait, you don't know what that button is?
No idea. It just says button. Let's see.
And we're stuck. So Project Ray is trying to make an easier-to-use smartphone with a simpler interface. Instead of relying on a screen reader to decode visual information, the phone is built so that anywhere you touch on the screen becomes your starting point. By making a device that's easier to use, Zilberman thinks he can sell more smartphones to blind people.
Practically every person, every blind person, do have a telephone. In our calculation, we are talking about a $1 billion industry that can be served with our tool.
The dream is to have one device that does everything a blind person needs. The problem with Ray is that third-party developers will have to write apps specifically for its new interface. For now, that means no Twitter, Facebook, or Tumblr, apps that Eliza Cooper uses for her job all the time. Cooper worries that if developers have to take that extra step, they won't, which is why she won't be giving up her iPhone anytime soon. I'm Meg Kramer for Marketplace.
Coming up, spoiler alert.
And spoiler alert, Nation, there's no greater social infraction than revealing whether Brody on Homeland is a terrorist, or, in my case, what happened to a certain member of Lord Grantham's family.
No, don't tell me. But first, let's do the numbers. No, seriously, don't tell me. I haven't seen it yet. The thing about Wall Street euphoria is it has a way of wearing off. Last week's big surge gave way to a 50-point drop for the Dow Industrials, about a third of 1%. 13,384 was the final number. The NASDAQ off 2 points, a tenth of 1%, 3,098 was the finish there. The S&P 500 trimmed off 4 points, almost a third of 1%, 1461 at the close. Corporate profits start coming out next week, and stock in Alcoa, which traditionally kicks off the reporting season, slipped 1.75% today. Bank of America shares withdrew around 0.1% after announcing that settlement with Fannie Mae over bad mortgages that Dan Bobkoff was telling about. Some other banks got a little boost after global regulators agreed on relaxing their cash reserve requirements. You try saying that 10 times fast. Shares of JP Morgan Chase and Citigroup each deposited gains of around 0.1%. Bond prices edged up, sent the yield on 10-year T-notes down to 1.90%. 1.9% flat, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to report consumer credit data for November. The International Consumer Electronics Show gets underway in Las Vegas. More than 1,200 exhibitors showcase wireless technologies. And on January 8, 1790, George Washington delivered the first State of the Union address in New York City. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So, you know how the government really needs money, right? Fiscal cliff, debt ceiling, all that. Well, NASA is going to sell off some of its excess inventory space shuttle stuff that's not used anymore. A landing strip nearly 3 miles long, a giant hangar, a launch pad or two. All of it on prime real estate as well. Beachfront property at Cape Canaveral. Marketplace's Jim Burris has the story.
When a furniture store goes out of business, you're going to know it.
Everything must be sold now.
When NASA liquidates, there are no fireworks or ringing cash registers. This is all about leasing the shuttle's old digs. And the process has been mostly low-key because the agency wants bidders to put forth their highest price without worrying about competitors.
Well, I would love to be the broker in that deal, for one thing.
Don Wood is a commercial real estate broker who has worked in the shadow of the Kennedy Space Center for decades. He estimates the whole facility is worth $5 to $7 billion. That's the tangible figure.
But we need to establish the intangible value, and that becomes the hard part.
In other words, what do history and the associated boost in public profile mean to companies like satellite and aerospace manufacturers? So we're not talking fire sale prices here, even if much of the Space Center needs fixing up.
There are a lot of facilities that are old and may have to be abandoned in place or demoed.
Frank DiBello heads Space Florida. It's charged with growing the state's aerospace industry, and in this case, helping to attract companies.
Many of those facilities that they have can have commercial use.
A NASA spokeswoman says she can't talk about specifics, but says there is a lot of interest, and it's not all aerospace. So the problem isn't about finding someone to lease parts of the facility. It is about finding one quickly. Federal funds to maintain Kennedy Space Center dry up at the end of the year. I'm Jim Burris for Marketplace.
Late night television is getting a New Year's shakeup. Tomorrow night, you're going to be able to catch Jimmy Kimmel's first show at his new time slot. It's 11:35 p.m. ABC moved him up a half an hour to compete directly with Leno and Letterman. Except that after Kimmel announced his move, Jay Leno said he's moving to a new time, too, 11:34. There is about a half $1 billion in ad revenue at stake in late night TV. But come on, a one-minute head start? Marketplace's David Weinberg reports.
Okay, I've got 1 minute to tell you what 1 minute of late-night network TV is worth. Joe Swalen thinks that one-minute head start Leno is giving himself isn't worth much at all. He's a chief research officer at Kantar Media, and he says people have largely made up their mind about which TV talk show host they prefer.
And 1 minute difference in start time isn't going to change that preference.
And if 1 minute really did make a difference, why do the networks give up five of them by starting their shows at 11:35 instead of 11:30?
It's a concession to the local affiliate stations.
The networks give that 5 minutes to their affiliates so they can squeeze a little extra ad revenue out of their local news, but it's not completely altruistic. Late night shows rely on local news to draw an audience that will stick around for them.
That's exactly what networks want to do. They want to go seamless from the local broadcast into the late night show.
Ann Easton is a contributor to Yahoo Television, and even though she knows the inner workings of seamless programming, she still can't resist it.
I'll be honest, I watch the local news, and that's exactly what happens to me a lot of times. I'm like, oh, hey, look who's going to be on Letterman tonight, or look who's going to be on Leno.
And that explains why local news ends with stories about water skiing squirrels. Easton says they put those lighthearted stories at the end of their broadcast because they're a perfect transition into the tone of late-night comedy. But Leno has more competition than just Kimmel and Letterman. Viewers have dozens of cable channels to choose from, and they're all competing for ad revenue. So that 1 minute of network programming isn't as valuable as it used to be. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
There are times on this broadcast we do honestly try to keep them few and far between, but there are times when we are obliged to delve into the internal gears of the global financial system, the guts of how it all works and why and what people are doing to make it work better. In that vein, there is news today of a fairly significant change in the financial rules of the road made by a group known as the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us to make it all make sense. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So, Stephen, you know, I mean, the Basel III Accords are nobody's idea of an easy and digestible news story. So make me understand why this change today matters.
For the first time, banks in the world's 20 biggest economies, that obviously includes the U.S. and all of Europe and Japan and China, will have to hold a certain amount of cash or assets that they can quickly turn into cash to deal with a crisis. And this is essentially designed to prevent a run so that people don't form lines five times around the block to pull their money out, because they'll know that the bank has easily got enough cash to pay them off if they want their money back.
But let me make sure everybody understands. What happened today was that those rules were eased, right? They were made less strict on the banks about these assets that they have to hold.
Yes. I mean, this has been watered down in two ways, this agreement. The new rule has been delayed. It won't now take effect until 2019. And as you say, the definition of liquid asset has been expanded quite a bit. I mean, they now include a whole bunch of things that we wouldn't normally think of as an easy asset to sell at short notice in a crisis.
For example?
Well, traditionally, it would just be government bonds and cash. But now, things like company shares, some company bonds, but raising eyebrows the most, mortgage-backed securities. Remember them?
I do.
The assets that almost blew up the planet only a few years ago. They proved very difficult to sell, if not impossible, and in many cases worthless. Now, you can see why some observers are getting a little bit nervous about this agreement.
Well, can you call this a win by the banks over the regulators?
Yes, I mean, that's certainly what it looks like. The banks have lobbied relentlessly. And critics of this agreement say they have been successful in getting exactly the rules that suit them.
Is this something, then, that I, as an individual account holder, should be worried about?
Probably not, no. I mean, it doesn't seem that at the moment, at least in these conditions, there is any danger of a run on the bank. And in fact, supporters of this agreement say it simply reflects the reality that now we all want the banks to lend more money. We don't really want to tie them down with tougher regulation. And if we do get into a situation, again, where there are major problems with a bank, then This slacker arrangement won't do us a great deal of good.
Stephen Beard with the latest in the twists and turns of the Basel Accords, as they're known. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Kai.
Must say I'm looking forward to getting me a little Downton Abbey time tonight, catching up with Lord Grantham, Lady Mary and the gang. Set the TiVo to catch last night's season premiere and have managed so far to stay spoiler-free. But commentator Beth Tytel points out spoiler safe havens are getting a good deal harder to find.
A few weeks ago, I inadvertently learned a major plot point on Downton Abbey, and now I'm living in a prison of my own making, a woman alone. My friends act like I've got a communicable disease. My husband doesn't trust his own soulmate to keep her mouth shut. As if I'd say anything. And spoiler alert, Nation, there's no greater social infraction than revealing whether Brody on Homeland is a terrorist, or who got eliminated on The Voice, or, in my case, what happened to a certain member of Lord Grantham's family. The spoiler problem has been building for years, but our ever-escalating ability to instantly share everything we know means that what happens on TV these days really doesn't stay on TV. Spoilers waft in through the air itself, via Twitter or Facebook, email or text. To be behind in a popular series, even by 10 minutes, is to live in a booby-trapped world. While there's no greater treat than the TV binge, watching multiple seasons of Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones in one lost weekend, we're suffering from a perfect storm of TV-related stress. The growing backlog of must-watch series has combined with greater flexibility of when and how we watch and more media outlets on which to learn what we can't unlearn. At this point, millions of Americans are at risk for spoilers. For some dramas, half the audience delays viewing. No one's better positioned to see all this procrastination than Nielsen, the TV ratings company. In 2008, the firm began counting shows watched up to 3 days later in its ratings. In 2011, the folks making the programs began lobbying advertisers to look at viewership numbers a whole week later. But even a week may be too short, as there's even growing interest to have shows watched years later count toward commercial audience numbers, just as long as current commercials are inserted into older airings. But here's the main issue. As a growing number of people not only watch shows that originally aired when George W. Bush was president, but become enraged at those who reveal their endings, we're faced with a newly urgent question. What's the spoiler statute of limitations? Citizen Kane?
Rosebud.
Beth Tytel is a staff reporter at the Boston Globe. Her most recent book is called Drinking Problems at the Fountain of Youth.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today about the numismatics of the debt ceiling crisis that's going to be upon us as soon as the Treasury Department runs out of money. Mid-February, early March sometime is the latest, we're being told. We told you Friday about the trillion-dollar platinum coin, a semi-tongue-in-cheek drive to get the Treasury Secretary to mint just a single coin made of platinum, decide that it's worth $1 trillion, and then use that coin to backstop all of our debt. Well, it was an interesting idea while it lasted. Oregon Republican Congressman Greg Walden said today he's going to introduce a bill outlawing trillion-dollar debt paying in platinum coins. Absurd and dangerous, he called that idea. No real appreciation for tongue-in-cheek either, I guess. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow off 50 points, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ down 2 points, a tenth percent. The S&P 500, it carved off 4 points, almost a third of 1%. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Jolie Podokas, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Ryssdal. I do hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.